on Sunday, the 26th, it's going to be the full moon. And the full moon in May is a very significant time for Buddhists throughout the world, of all traditions. It is a time when we remember with gratitude and appreciation the teacher, the Buddha, because he was born on a full moon in May. He also obtained enlightenment on the full moon in May. And he passed away in May on the full moon. And so this is a ceremony which we call Visakha ceremony. It is the ceremony of the recollection of the Buddha's birth, enlightenment and parinibbana, final passing away. And because it is such an important and significant event this weekend, there will be many services and celebrations around this event. And because many of you may be unfamiliar with the life of the Buddha and especially the period of his passing away, I thought this evening to take one of the discourses, one of the longest discourses, which recalls and remembers the events of the Buddha's last days and the teachings he gave, particularly in those last days. I want to present this discourse on the last days of the Buddha from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta by giving a commentary and giving you some information and background and filling in around the events, and then also reading the very words of the Buddha on those relevant parts of the discourse. For those who are unfamiliar with the life of the Buddha lived to an age of 80. He was enlightened at the age of 35, and so he taught for 45 years, wandering throughout Middle India and Northern India, teaching those people who were interested and when he was invited. This discourse on the last days of the Buddha, there is a lot of Dhamma teachings in that, and it seems to be a period that Buddha knew he was going to pass away. He actually predicted his death and announced it 3 months before the events that he will pass away on the full moon in May. And in those last 3 months, he travelled extensively, meeting with monks and lay people and nuns, and often reiterated and emphasized very poignant parts of his teaching that he'd been teaching for 45 years. So in this discourse, there is often the most important teachings of the Buddha, as well as an emphasis where he's trying to remind people of his teachings, what's important, what you should remember before he passes away. Also, he summarizes to the listeners those teachings. And he also points out the essence of his teachings and gives some final guidance and advice. I will begin this by giving you a bit of background. The discourse begins, that is the discourse on the Buddha's last days, begins in a period of political turmoil in the area of Magadha, that's central northern India. At that time, the kings of the area were planning to go to war, and there was a lot of political strife looming. And because of that, those conditions, the beginning of the discourse starts with the Buddha talking about those conditions for social stability and those conditions for harmony. And he then gives guidance to the monks on conditions for their welfare and growth and benefit, and those conditions that lead to their happiness and their prosperity, and those conditions which lead away from decline. I will not go into the details of that, but begin where the Buddha starts to then give an analysis and a summary of his teachings, and I will go on to describe those. And so the Buddha is abiding at the area in India called Rajagaha, which was a very ancient and very powerful kingdom and capital of one of the great kings at that time. And he lived on a mountaintop around the outskirts of the city called the Vulture's Peak. And it's a mountain which has a large rocky outcrop, which looks like a vulture's head. And of those of you who have been to India, you can still see the remnants of the Buddha's kuti that exists on the top of that vulture's peak to this day. That is these brick remnants of the foundation stone of his hut where he abided. And so when the Blessed One was living on the vulture's peak, he spoke to the monks and said, "This is morality, this is concentration, this is wisdom." Concentration, when imbued with morality, brings great fruit and profit. Wisdom, when imbued with concentration, brings great fruit and profit. The mind imbued with wisdom becomes completely free from corruptions, that is, from the corruptions of sensuality, of becoming, of false views, and of ignorance. So the Buddha is summarizing his pathway to enlightenment. And his pathway to enlightenment is describing as based in virtue, in morality. It is based in peace and concentration. And it is based in wisdom. And they work together. Those three things must work together. So it is not good enough, if one aspires to enlightenment, to say, just meditate. One also has to support meditation with virtue and goodness. Virtue and goodness is the very supports for peaceful states of mind. And wisdom, when it is supported by peaceful states of mind, serenity, calmness, and one-pointedness, that brings great fruit and benefit, because the power of the mind to see something clearly then is able to hold that object for a long period of time and therefore know it as it really is. So when you can sustain the mind on one thing for a long period of time, then the mind becomes pure, the mind becomes radiant, the mind becomes malleable, mind becomes clear. And in that purity, in that radiance, in that clarity, then one can see very clearly. It's when we have a problem and we're confused, we're overcome by anxiety and doubt and stress, we can't see the problem because we're too close to it. It's only when we become more peaceful, more clear, and we put some space between ourselves and the problem, then we can understand it as it is and know it in a different way. And so too, when the mind is strengthened by the purity of concentration, then that mind can become freed from the corruptions. The corruptions in Buddhism is those things that lead to defilements of the mind. It disturbs the mind, distorts the mind, and makes the mind impure. And those defilements are three taints. They are the taints of sensual desire, the taint of always looking for pleasure through the body. If one is always seeking pleasure through the body, then the mind cannot be at peace. How can the mind be happy if one's always looking or pleasant sights, sounds, tastes, smell and touch? That always sends the mind outward to the world. The pure mind, the still mind, is when the mind is content. We've experienced those times when our mind has come to stillness and peace. And it's when we're inwardly happy, inwardly content. It's not when we're searching and seeking more pleasure, but we're happy with what we have. When we're happy then the mind can go inward. Also, one of the corruptions that distort and distill the mind is this desiring for eternal existence. This is this always wanting to be, to become, to do. This is the fear arises because of this sense of I exist. And anything that threatens the I brings up fear. So we can never find security because of this view of self, this sense of always trying to perpetuate being. And then the other corruption of mind is wrong view. Wrong view is to not see the Four Noble Truths, to not see why we suffer, to not see the cause of suffering, to not see that there is a release from suffering, and to not understand the path to that release. And so to not understand, why am I suffering? Why is there unhappiness? To not see that there is dukkha, there is suffering, there is unsatisfactoriness. With birth, there must be old age, sickness, and death. And that is a natural consequence, a natural cause of having been born. There is the arising of things and passing away. And because all things must arise and must pass away, that makes them unsatisfactory to attach to and to hold on to. One allows them to come and go. And when one sees that there is this arising and passing away, then nothing is stable, nothing can be held on to. No security can be found in the world which constantly changes. And because of that, then the world is unsatisfactory. And then what causes the dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness? It is craving. It is a desire for things not to change. We desire not to be separated from what we love. But is that possible? We desire to have only pleasure and never experience pain. But is that possible? We desire to only have pleasant experiences. But is that possible? We desire only good health, not ill health. But is that possible? We desire not to grow old and not to die. But that's not possible. And so we see that the changing nature of existence causes suffering because of our desire and clinging to things to be a certain way. And then this wrong view that we do not see that there is a path out, there is an escape, there is a liberation. By giving up craving, giving up desire, then we're freed from suffering. We allow nature to take its course. And also to know that there is a pathway to escape from suffering, a pathway for abandoning desire, which is this very pathway of morality, concentration, and wisdom. And the last of the corruptions of mind is ignorance. And ignorance is that which prevents one from seeing the true nature of things. We see things as permanent when they're really impermanent. We see things as substantial when they're really unsubstantial. We see things as bringing happiness when they fade away and lead to cessation, ending, therefore bring unhappiness. So we see things as essentially eternally beautiful when things are always fading. The flowers on the shrine look beautiful, but they will fade. Because we don't see the fading of things, the fading of life, then we attach to things as being beautiful and do not see their ending. then the Buddha moved on after giving that discourse, he moved on and travelled to other parts of India. And in these final days, one of his great disciples, the Venerable Sariputta, came up to him. And the Venerable Sariputta was renowned for his wisdom. And he made a statement in the presence of the Buddha because of his faith and devotion to the Buddha. He said, he made the claim that the Buddha Gautama must be the highest, the best of all the enlightened ones, all the Buddhas of the past, and in the future there will be no greater or higher Buddha than him. Remembering that a Buddha is just someone who realizes truth. And there is only one Buddha in one world system, in one period, at one time. And the Buddha Gautama is one Buddha of Buddhas of the past, and there will be future Buddhas. And the Buddha asked Sariputta that was a brave statement. Do you actually know the minds of all the Buddhas of the past? Do you know their virtue? Do you know the extent of their teachings? Do you know their wisdom? And do you know their path of liberation? And Venerable Sariputta said, well, of course I don't. No, I don't. But what he does go on to say is, which is an interesting statement, he says, Venerable Sir, the Blessed One, the minds of the Arahant Buddhas, the enlightened Buddhas of the past and future and present, are not open to me, but I know the drift of the Dhamma, that is, I know their teachings, I understand their teachings. And then he goes on to state that, he said, all those enlightened Buddhas of the past have obtained supreme enlightenment by abandoning the five hindrances, defilements of mind that weaken understanding. Having firmly established the four foundations of mindfulness in their mind and realized the seven factors of enlightenment as they really are, all the enlightened Buddhas of the future will do likewise. And you, Venerable Sir, Lord Buddha, who now is the Arahant, fully enlightened Buddha, have done the same. So here, it's actually Sariputta is making a statement, and the Buddha agrees with him and acknowledges that statement, that to become an enlightened Buddha, there are three things, three qualities of mind that one has to develop, and also to become an enlightened one, for all of us to become enlightened, there are three things that we have to do. And the first is to abandon the five hindrances, which weaken wisdom, weaken understanding, which are the food for ignorance. And what are the five hindrances? For many of you, you will be aware of them. The first is the hindrance of sensuality, that is, seeking pleasure for the body. The next is the hindrance of ill will, of hatred and aversion, that weakens wisdom. An angry person does not see. An angry person is prejudicial. Same with a person who is seeking their own pleasure. Then they become prejudicial in making decisions. They will take more than is needed because of desire. They will seek their own satisfaction and maybe exploit others because of desire. So sensuality and ill will destroys clarity, destroys wisdom. And also, to become enlightened, one has to overcome doubt and confusion. What is the path to peace? What is the path to liberation? Why was I born? Where am I going after death? These doubts, these confusions about the direction of your life, the direction of the spiritual path, undermine certainty and leads to confusion. For an enlightened one, that doubt is destroyed. And also sloth, laziness, the dullness, that is overcome. One is energized and alert and bright and clear. The enlightened one has destroyed laziness and sloth. And also the enlightened one has overcome all restlessness of mind. Their mind is serene and peaceful, is unshaken. so much of our movement to do things, to act, to speak, comes out of restlessness, the lack of contentment, the lack of ability to be still. And that's why we seek pleasure outside of ourselves, because of this restlessness. And the seeking for pleasure leads to even further restlessness. The other factor that Sariputta mentions, that all the Buddhas of the past, the present and the future will develop, and all enlightened ones will develop, is the four foundations of mindfulness. The four foundations of mindfulness is to become aware of what you're doing with the physical body, to know your body. What are you doing now? How are you sitting? Because if you're not in the body, not aware of the body, then your mind is somewhere else. It is not here right now. To know feelings, to know the nature of feelings, the nature of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings of body and mind when they arise and pass away, so that we're not a slave to feeling, because craving and desire arise because of feeling. When we experience a pleasant feeling, then we desire to sustain that feeling, don't we? When we feel pain, then there's a desire to annihilate, destroy, get rid of that pain. So the mind rejects pain. And neutral feeling, we don't even know it. We're not aware of it. So the enlightened mind knows feeling when it arises and knows when it subsides, knows what type of feeling, whether it's bodily feeling or mental feeling of pleasure, pain, or neutral, and knows its characteristic, that this is not me, this is not mine, this is not self. And the enlightened mind also has developed the four foundations of knowing the mind, knowing thoughts when they arise and pass away, knowing opinions, knowing views, knowing ideas as conditioned phenomena, and has also known dhammas. The other quality that the Buddhas of all the past, the present and the future, and all enlightened beings must develop is the seven factors of enlightenment, those qualities that will lead to liberation. And those seven factors of enlightenment are mindfulness, to be consciously aware, fully alert of the present moment, to know, to remember. Also energy, to be energized to develop wholesome states and overcome on unwholesome states, to sustain wholesome qualities and abandon unwholesome qualities. This is what we call energy, effort in Buddhism. It's if you have a thought of loving kindness, to make a conscious effort to sustain that thought for as long as possible. That is right effort. That is the effort that will take you to liberation. If you have a thought of abandonment, of renunciation, sustain that thought for a long time. If you have a thought of generosity, you have a thought of kindness, a thought of virtue, then to sustain that thought for a long, long time. That is right effort. That is the effort that will take one closer and closer to enlightenment. And when we see anger arise, when we see sensuality arise, when we see cruelty arise in the mind, to make an effort to abandon these, to recognize these qualities are far from the enlightened ones. Would I like to die with a thought of anger in my mind? A thought of anger is not a quality of an arahant, of a Buddha. A thought of selfishness is not a quality which is appropriate for a person striving for the highest, for liberation. A thought of delusion and fear and anxiety and conceit, those too should be abandoned. So we make an effort to abandon these qualities. and also to investigate truth and to develop tranquility. So making oneself more tranquil and calm by developing contentment. How do we become tranquil? It's by developing an attitude of joyous contentment in the mind. Because the mind becomes serene when there's a sense of gladness in wholesomeness. When there's gladness in what is good, what is noble, then that makes the mind very happy and joyous. And when the mind is happy and joyous, then the body becomes tranquil and the mind calms down. It's just like when you've been on holiday and you've been kind to people, you're relaxed, you're at ease, you can lay down on the beach and just unwind. Be at ease, let go of the world. Just let go of things, just trust in your own goodness, in your own virtue, and then you become tranquil, you relax and are at ease. And joy and concentration and equanimity are the other factors of enlightenment which are needed to be developed and are developed and made much of by the enlightened disciples. And I will move on, because there is another section where the Buddha then says, "Monks, it is through not understanding, not penetrating the Four Noble Truths that I, as well as you, have for a long time run on and gone around in the cycle of birth and death. What are they? By not understanding the noble truth of suffering, we have fed on. By not understanding the noble truth of the origin of suffering, of the cessation of suffering, of the path leading to the cessation of suffering, we have fed on the round of cycle of birth and death. And by the understanding and penetration of the same noble truth of suffering, of the origin of suffering, of the cessation of suffering, of the path leading to the cessation of suffering, the craving for becoming has cut off, the support for becoming has been destroyed, there is no more re-becoming." So this is where the Buddha is summarizing his teaching, that he is saying, for himself, before he became enlightened, just as with all of us, the reason that we're going on in this endless round and cycle of birth and death, in the endless round of samsara, that which goes on, is because of not understanding the noble truth of suffering, and not understanding that birth is suffering, old age is suffering, pain, grief and despair is suffering. Getting what one doesn't want is suffering. Being separated from what one loves is suffering. The five khandhas of existence, body, thought, feeling, perception and consciousness, because of their constant change, that too is suffering. And so, not understanding this, we continue to grasp with clinging to existence. And so, we go on in this round of existence. And it is only through the knowing of these four truths that one can find liberation from this endless round of becoming. And then the Buddha travels to a village called Nadika. And there's actually an interesting event that happens there, that at this village of Nadika, the Buddha was traveling around by foot at that time. Remember, he was 80 years old and still traveling and teaching as he went. And Venerable Ananda, the Buddha's attendant and disciple, came up to the Buddha and asked the Buddha that there was a number of monks and nuns and also lay people who died in that town. And he requested the Buddha to tell him where these people were reborn, because the Buddha had the psychic ability to know which realm of existence they had taken rebirth in. And the Buddha actually says, "Ananda, in Nadika, more than 50 lay followers have, by the destruction of the lower fetters, been spontaneously reborn and will gain enlightenment from that state without returning to this world. another 90 by the destruction of the three fetters, the destruction of greed, hatred, and delusion, are once returners who will come back once more to this world and then make an end of suffering. And well over 500 by the destruction of the three fetters are stream enterers, incapable of falling into states of woe, certain of obtaining nibbana. So here the Buddha was actually talking at that time that many lay followers had actually entered up to 50 in this one town, had became non-returners. That is, they will next existence, they will not come back to this world, they will enter nibbana. Others had become once returners, and a large number, up to 500 of the lay people at that time, became stream enterers. That is, the eye of the Dhamma had come up to them. They had seen the Four Noble Truths and understood them and were destined to enlightenment. So we can see at that time that many of the lay disciples of the Buddha saw the Dhamma. And then it's interesting that the Buddha actually says to Ananda, Ananda, if you keep on asking me, where someone goes to after they die, then that would be very troublesome. He said, it's not remarkable that a person dies, but I'll teach you a way of knowing the Dhamma called the mirror of the Dhamma, where an Aryan disciple, if he so wishes, can discern for himself, I have destroyed hell, animal rebirth, the realms of ghosts, of downfall, the states of sorrow. I am a stream winner, incapable of falling into these states of woe. I am certain of obtaining enlightenment. So here the Buddha has said, Ananda, instead of asking me about all the time where this person has gone after death, if this person has got enlightened, if this person has seen the Dhamma, I will give you a teaching now, so that now and in the future, a person, by understanding this teaching, can hold a mirror up to themselves and say, am I destined for enlightenment? Will I obtain enlightenment? Will I obtain? Am I a stream winner? That means, will I obtain enlightenment within 7 lifetimes? And he says, it is with this mirror that one can discern this. Here, Ananda, the Aryan disciple is possessed of unwavering confidence in the Buddha thus. The Blessed One is an Arahant, fully enlightened Buddha, endowed with wisdom and conduct, the welfarer, knower of the worlds, incomparable trainer of people to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened and blessed. So here the Buddha is saying that if you have that unshakable confidence in the Buddha as being completely enlightened, you have that unshakable confidence that the Buddha was an Arahant, someone who has destroyed greed, hatred, and delusion. If you have that faith and trust that he knew the pathway to liberation and could train those people who wished to follow that path, then that is one of the aspects of the mirror to the Dhamma, to know that I too am destined to enlightenment. If one also, he goes on to say, is possessed of unwavering faith in the Dhamma, well proclaimed is the Dhamma by the Lord, visible here and now, timeless, inviting inspection, leading inward, to be comprehended by the wise, each for themselves. So here the Buddha is saying that this teaching he teaches should be investigated, it should be considered, it should be taken away and practiced. That this teaching that he teaches is timeless. It is not an ancient tradition that was relevant for 2,500 years ago in India. It is relevant here and now. And it is to be known here and now. The Dhamma is visible here and now. If one's mind inclines to that, then maybe someone in this audience can become enlightened at this point in time. Can see the Dhamma here and now. It is timeless. That is, it is not bound by the convention of time. It invites inspection. It is encouraging you to investigate and consider, is this true? What can I know? What can I know of suffering? Do I have suffering in my life? Where are my attachments? Where are my loves? Where are my hates? Where are my desires? What do I cling to that causes me pain and unsatisfactoriness? That you can know. You do not have to ask anybody else. You can see for yourself. And by abandoning those cravings, those clingings, those attachments, you can see that one is freed from that pain and suffering that those clinging and attachments cause. And also by seeing the freedom and liberation that arises by putting forward a pathway of morality, of concentration and wisdom, how that purifies the mind. You can see and know that for yourself. And this teaching leads inward. The Buddha's teaching is not going out to finding information and knowledge about the world outside you. It's about finding knowledge and information about this body and this mind. What can we know about our own minds? What can we see and understand of what's going on in our own world experience? And it can be comprehended by the wise, each for themselves. So only us, we ourselves, will know when we become enlightened. You will know whether you're angry or not. You will know greed. You can know delusion. But you can also know freedom from anger. We can know loving kindness, can't we? We can know thoughts of compassion. And we can know thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of generosity and goodwill. We can know that this liberation from these unwholesome states, we can understand and perceive for ourselves. We don't have to ask somebody else to reconfirm whether we're suffering or not. We know for ourselves. So the Buddha's path is turning us inwards onto ourselves. So here the Buddha is saying the Dhamma truth should turn you to yourself, to know yourself, know this mind. And also the mirror to the Dhamma to know whether you're destined for enlightenment is that person possesses unwavering faith and confidence in the Sangha. Well directed is the Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples, of upright conduct, on the right path, on the perfect path. That is to say, the four pairs of persons and the eight kinds of humans. This means this is the enlightened disciples of the Buddha, that one has a confidence that there are beings and people who, like the Buddha, practice this path and became enlightened. And that one too can practice this same path and become enlightened. If one has this trust and confidence and the heart leaps forward, then one will put the effort in to put forth the realizations and the qualities to realize enlightenment. So the four pairs of persons and the eight kinds of human beings is, that is the stream enterer, the person who's seen the Dhamma, and the person who's on the pathway to seeing that Dhamma. So as a person who is about to obtain that liberation has entered the path. As a person who is the once returner, and also the one who's on the path to becoming a once returner. The person who's a non-returner, does not come back to this world, and the person who's on that path. The person who is fully enlightened and the person who's on that path. They're called the eight kinds of noble beings in the world. Those people who are destined for enlightenment are noble in the world. They're very rare. And to meet a person who is enlightened is very, very rare and a great blessing. To even hear that there are enlightened ones gives us the opportunity to know, oh, someone has overcome anger in their own minds and has conquered that. I too can conquer my anger. Someone has overcome selfishness. I too can conquer selfishness. Someone has overcome fear and delusion. I too can conquer and overcome these. So it gives us the confidence and trust to make an effort, to strive, to seek release. And so the Buddha says that a person who has these three qualities, this then is... when one has this, is a mirror to the Dhamma, where one, an Aryan disciple, can discern for themselves, I have destroyed the lower realms, I am a stream winner, I am certain to obtain enlightenment. And so this is, you can see that these are aspects of faith. One has faith and trust and confidence in the enlightened Buddha, his teachings, and the path. Then after giving that, this is a point where the Buddha starts to get very ill. And he spent his range retreat that year. The Lord spent his last range retreat, the Blessed One, spent the range retreat at Belovar. And during the range retreat, the Blessed One was attacked by a severe sickness with sharp pains, as if he was about to die. But he endured this mindfully, clearly aware and without complaining. And he said to his disciple, Ananda, I am now old, Ananda, worn out, venerable, one who has transversed life's path. I have reached the term of life, which is 80 years old. Just as an old cart is made to go on by being held together by straps, so the Tathagata, the Buddha's body, is kept going by being strapped up. It is only when the Tathagata, the Blessed One, draws his attention away from outer signs and, with the cessation of certain feelings, enters in the signless concentration of mind that his body knows comfort. So the Buddha is saying here that the only time that his physical body feels comfortable because of his old age is when he turns his mind into these deep states of concentration, when he turns his mind away from feelings in the body and goes into the signless concentration of mind. Then there's comfort, because even a Buddha feels pain. If you become enlightened, you will still feel pain, but only physical pain. There will not be the mental pain, the mental suffering, until you will not have anguish. So even though you may be decrepit and old, there won't be the mental anguish to seek death. There will just be the knowing of feelings arising because of the body. There won't be mental discomfort. And when then the Buddha recovered from that particular illness, and Venerable Ananda came up to the Buddha and actually asked him, will you make a statement about who should take over the order of monks after you leave? And this is actually a very important point that the Buddha then goes on to teach Ananda. He says, Ananda, do not request of me to make a statement about the order of monks. I have taught you the Dhamma. I do not teach with an inner and outer or with a closed fist in respect to the Dhamma. So what the Buddha is saying here is, I did not teach having an inner circle and an outer circle of disciples. I have just taught the Dhamma. So here the Buddha is saying categorically that in Buddhism there should not be any esoteric teachings, which when you're an intimate disciple, I'll give you the higher Dhamma, and otherwise you're kept on the outer circle. He's always said, I've always taught the Dhamma truth. I've always taught the teachings with an open hand. Anyone who wants to see that can. And that is why the Buddha's teachings are always given freely. They are given with an open hand. It's for those. Truth is always to be exposed and opened up and shown for those who want to know it. It is not saying, I will hold this secret teaching only for those intimate disciples who have done a particular initiation, who are particularly close to me, who have given me a huge donation. Is saying, this truth is there for those beings who want to find liberation. It is offered freely. It is offered for the wise, those people who have little dust in their eyes, to take it as they see fit. And so the Buddha is categorically stating here that I do not teach with a closed fist, but with an open hand. There is no secret teaching that I have not taught, or some secret teaching I have kept only for the initiated. but I have always taught openly. And then the Buddha goes on to make a very powerful and very famous statement, which you may have heard. He said, "Therefore, Ananda, you should all be an island unto yourselves, being your own refuge, with no one else as your refuge, with the Dhamma as an island, with the Dhamma as your refuge, with no other refuge. And how does a person live as an island unto themselves, with no other refuge? Here, Ananda, a person abides contemplating this body earnestly, clearly aware, mindful, and having put away all hankering and fettering for the world, and likewise with regard to feelings, mind and mind objects. That, Ananda, is how a person lives as an island unto themselves, with no other refuge. And those who now in my time or afterwards live thus, they will become enlightened, they will become the highest, if they desirest of learning." So the Buddha is saying that I haven't got a secret teaching that I've kept for this last moment of my life, or I haven't got a secret teaching that I've kept for some disciples. I've taught the Dhamma, that is the truth, the teachings, and you take that as your refuge. Don't take your refuge in an individual or something outside of yourself. Take refuge in your own island of the Dhamma. Take your refuge in truth. Take your refuge in that and not in any other being. And how do you know this truth? It is by developing mindfulness of the body, feeling, mind and mind objects. Because that's our whole world, isn't it? We can know our body. We can know feelings. We can know thoughts and ideas. And we can know those concepts that arise in the mind and experiences through the mind in consciousness. That we can know. So take that as your refuge, not taking refuge in things outside, in the material things of the world, in structures or traditions. You take refuge in the Dhamma, in truth. Make that your island. And then the Buddha actually goes on to say a very important section of this, which he actually says, how do we know what is who to believe? And the Buddha actually says that Venerable Ananda, I'll paraphrase here, Venerable Ananda asks him, well, who should we believe? And the Buddha says, well, whoever you hear, whatever monk or teacher, whatever person says, these are the teachings of the Buddha. You should neither delight in or reject, approve or disapprove of those words. But you should note carefully and listen carefully. But then you should compare those teachings with the words of the Buddha in the suttas, in the discourses. And if those words taught by that teacher, whoever that teacher may be, compare favorably with that teacher, however distinguished that teacher may be, then you can say, yes, these are the words of the Buddha, and they can be taken up and say, assuredly, these are the words of the Buddha. It has been rightly understood by this monk or teacher. So here it's actually a very important aspect of we shouldn't just be saying, oh, yeah, I believe something because Ajahnyanadhammo told me so. You should say, oh, does what he says compares to those words of the Buddha that is found in the suttas? And look to what the Buddha said. And if anything I say or any other person says does not compare, then for a Buddhist, we always take refuge in the Buddha. That's what means by being a Buddhist, isn't it? We take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, the enlightened ones. So if any great teacher does not say those words that does compare to the words of the Buddha, then one can discount that, that is not correct, not is true. So that becomes your great standard, your great measure for knowing the Dhamma. And then finally, the Buddha summarizes his teachings. He says, the Blessed One addressed the monks, "It is, monks, through not understanding, not penetrating four things, that I, as well as you, have for a long time fed on the round of cycle of rebirth. What are the four things? It is not understanding the enlightened morality or the Aryan morality, that is the enlightened or the noble virtue. Through not understanding noble concentration, through not understanding noble wisdom, through not understanding noble liberation, I, as well as you, have for a long time fed on in the round of the cycle of rebirth, and it is by understanding and penetrating noble virtue, the noble concentration, the noble wisdom, and the noble liberation that the craving for becoming has been cut off, the tendency towards becoming has been exhausted, and there will be no more rebirth." So the cause that we causes us to go on in the cycle of existence, to make the same mistakes over and over again, is by not understanding noble virtue, noble concentration, and noble wisdom, and noble liberation. But if we develop understanding of and cultivate our virtues so it becomes purified, it becomes perfected, then we can incline to noble concentration. And when we purify our states of mind, make the mind serene, peaceful, one-pointed and calm, we perfect the mind so it goes to purity, luminosity, to malleability, to purity, then noble wisdom will arise. We'll see things as they really are. We'll know the arising of things and their cessation. We'll see there is impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. And that noble wisdom will then lead to the noble liberation, when we will destroy and cut off the causes for becoming. I did mention that the Buddha predicted and announced that he knew 3 months ahead of time that he would finally pass away in the town of Kusinara on the full moon in May. So he made that prediction in February, and then he traveled throughout India still teaching. And in this discourse, there is a summary of those teachings and some of the relevant teachings that the Buddha wanted to re-emphasize, so that his disciples, both monks, nuns, and lay men and women, would remember the significance of those teachings for a long time. And because those teachings have been remembered, we too, here today, can hear those teachings, reflect on them, practice them, and make them have effect in our hearts and in our minds. And this first part of this evening's discourse begins with the final illness. It's the final days of the Buddha, when he receives an invitation from a gentleman called Chanda, who was a goldsmith, to come and have a meal at his house. And after the Buddha partook of that meal, which is a dish which is sometimes considered to be a meat dish, after having taken that meal, the Buddha was attacked by a severe sickness with bloody diarrhea and with sharp pains as if he was about to die. But he endured all this mindfully and clearly aware, without complaint. And then the Buddha said to Ananda, "Let us go to Kusinara." "Very good, Lord," said Ananda. So the Buddha is struck down with food poisoning. And it is very interesting that the Buddha did say to Ananda, even though he got sick from that layperson's meal, he told Ananda later on, that it might happen, Ananda, that the goldsmith Chunda may feel remorse that I offered the meal that led to his final illness, and therefore blame himself that the Tathagata entered Nirvana, the final Nirvana, after taking his last meal from him. But that smith, Chunda, should not remorse. You should go and tell that smith that it is your merit, Chunda, it is your good deed that the Tathagata gained final Nirvana after taking his last meal from you. For, friend Smith, Chunda, I have heard and understood from the Blessed One's own lips that there are two forms of almsgiving that are of great fruit, of very great result, more fruit and advantageous of any other. What two? The one is the giving of food or alms, after eating which the Tathagata obtains supreme enlightenment. The other, after which he obtains the Nibbana element without remainder at his final passing. These two forms of alms offering are more fruitful and profitable than any other. Chunda's deeds is conducive to long life, to happiness, to prosperity, that is, to nobility. And so here the Buddha was getting Ananda, his attendant, to go back and tell that layperson who offered the meal, you shouldn't blame yourself that the Buddha is sick. It is inevitable that he will die. And that this last meal is actually of great merit because it is a gift, a purely given gift. There was no intention to make him ill. It is just he was coming to the end of his life, and this was just a causal condition. But that gift is of great merit. And another meal that is of great merit, to give the highest merit, is the person who gives the food that the Bodhisattva takes before his enlightenment, the day or the night of his enlightenment, because it is a causal condition to give them the physical strength, or him the physical strength, to realize Nibbana. And then after the Buddha is quite sick, the Buddha he's feeling weak, so he takes a seat under a tree by the side of the road, and a layman, Okusa, of the Malas, he comes past, and he starts up a conversation with the Buddha and becomes so inspired. This man is a very wealthy merchant, and after that conversation, his inspiration is such that he wants to offer a set of robes, both to the Buddha and to Venerable Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, and he offers robes of gold color, golden cloth. And then Venerable Ananda puts one set of robes on the Buddha, and he wears one set. And he notices that the set of robes he put on the Buddha, the robes appeared dull, that the Buddha's skin became radiant. And he said, "It is wonderful, O Lord, it is marvelous how clear and bright the Lord Buddha's skin appears. It looks even brighter than the golden robes in which I have robed you." Just so, Ananda, there are two occasions in which a Tathagata's skin appears especially clear and bright. Which are they? One is the night in which the Tathagata obtains supreme enlightenment. The other is the night when he obtains Nibbana element without remainder at his final passing away. On these two occasions, the Tathagata's skin appears especially clear and bright. So there's two occasions in the life of the Buddha when his skin becomes extremely radiant. And that's why we do have golden Buddha images as a tradition. It is that show that radiance of the time of the night of the enlightenment of the Buddha. His skin becomes golden and radiant. It's because of the power of the purity of the mind, and at the time of his final passing away. And then the Buddha goes and tells Ananda, "Tonight, Ananda, in the last watch of the night, that's between 3 and 6 a.m., in the Sala grove near Kusinara, between two Sala trees, the Tathagata the Buddha's final passing away will take place. And now, Ananda, let us go to Kusinara. So the Buddha tells Ananda that tonight I will pass away. And then Ananda and the Buddha travel by foot to Kusinara, and they cross the river. And then Ananda, because the Buddha is feeling weak and the Buddha is going to pass away on this full night in May, the Buddha asks Ananda to lay out his robe between two sala trees, which is a tree that was in blossom. And he placed his head to the north and lied down. And he laid on his right side in what we call the lion's posture, placing one foot mindfully on the other. And his mindfulness was clear and bright. And those twin sala trees birthed forth in abundance of untimely blossom, which fell on the Tathagata's body, sprinkling it with a covering in homage. And it is said that divine coral tree flowers fell from the sky, and the fragrance of sandalwood was smelt in the air, and they sprinkled the Tathagata's body. And there was heavenly music from the devas in the sky. And here the Buddha said to Ananda, Ananda, these trees have burst forth into blossom, in an untimely blossom, and there is a sound of deva-like music. This is one way of paying homage to the Buddha. But here he goes on to say, yet Ananda, whatever monk, nun, lay man or lay woman follower dwells practicing the Dhamma properly and perfectly fulfills the Dhamma way, he or she honors the Tathagata, reveres and esteems him, and pays him the supreme homage. Therefore, Ananda, we will dwell practicing the Dhamma properly and perfectly fulfilling the Dhamma way. This must be your watchword. So here the Buddha is saying that even though there is the offering of candles, flowers and incense, this is devotion. But the highest form of devotion to the Buddha is by fulfilling his teachings, by practicing his path. And that is the way to revere him, to esteem him. And that should be our watchword, to perfect and fulfill the Dhamma way. And then the Lord Buddha says, Venerable Ananda asked the Buddha, he said, formerly before, wherever you are staying, the monks would come and see you and visit you. Now where should they go to remember you? And the Buddha actually says, Venerable Ananda, there are four places the sight of which should arouse emotion in the faithful. Which are they? The place where the Tathagata was born is the first. The place where the Buddha, the Tathagata, obtained supreme enlightenment is the second. The place where the Tathagata set rolling the wheel of the Dhamma, his teachings, is the third. And the place where the Buddha obtained Nibbana element, Parinibbana, without remainder, is the last. Here, Ananda, the faithful monks, nuns, male and female lay followers will visit those places, and any who die while making that pilgrimage to these shrines with a devout heart will, at the breaking up of the body after death, be reborn in a heavenly world. So as both monks, nuns, and lay men and women followers, if you want to recall the Tathagata and you want to do that as a pilgrimage, then the Buddha said on his last days, the last night, then go to the place where he was born. Go to the physical place where he obtained enlightenment at Bodhigaya. Go to the place in Saranath where he taught the Dhamma. And go to Kusinara where he passed away. And bow down out of reverence, recollecting the Buddha, his teachings, and the Sangha. And that will be for your long-lasting benefit and happiness. And then the Buddha gives his final advice about to Ananda, because Ananda asks him. He asks him about his funeral. How should we arrange your funeral? And the Buddha said to Ananda, "Don't worry yourself about funeral arrangements, Ananda. You should strive for the highest goal. Devote yourself to the highest goal. Dwell with your minds tirelessly, zealously devoted to the highest goal." And then he goes on to say, there are lay people who will take care of the Tathagata's body and take care of the funeral arrangements. So he's giving advice always to the monks and nuns not to worry about the physical body, even the Buddha's body. That's not his concern. His concern is that all of us realize the Dhamma. That's our highest and devoted goal. But then Ananda continues and asks, well, what should we do with your ashes after our cremation? And the Buddha suggests that it's appropriate to build a stupa. So this is how, in Buddhism, we have come up with the traditions of stupas, because the Buddha himself said it's appropriate to put his ashes in a mound, in a stupa, and whoever lays wreaths of flowers and sweet perfumes and colors there at that stupa with a devoted heart will reap benefit and happiness for a long time. And a Buddha is someone who is appropriate to build a stupa for, because he is an arahant, fully enlightened. A pratyeka Buddha is also someone, a silent Buddha, is someone who it's appropriate to build a stupa for. Or a disciple of the Buddha is appropriate to build a stupa for, or a will-turning monarch. And so then, after Venerable Ananda, who is the Buddha's cousin, and he's looked after the Buddha for many years, he is a sotapanna, a stream enterer. After he talks to the Buddha on his final night of passing away about these funeral arrangements for the Buddha, he's overcome with grief. And he leaves the Buddha and goes back to his hut, and he leans against the door, crying. He's lamenting. I am still a learner with much to do. The teacher is passing away, who was so compassionate to me. And he is at a loss because the Buddha is finally passing to Nibbana, Parinibbana. And then the Buddha, even though he's very ill, he asks the monks, where is Ananda gone? And the monks tell the Buddha that he is lamenting that the Buddha is passing away. So the Buddha tells the monks, go, monks, and call dear Ananda, Venerable Ananda, my good friend, to come to me. And Ananda comes and bows down to the Buddha, and the Lord Buddha instructs him, enough, Ananda, do not weep. Have I not already told you that all things that are pleasant and delightful are changeable, subject to separation and becoming other? So how could it be, Ananda, since whatever is born, become, compounded, is subject to decay, how could it be that it should not pass away? For a long time, Ananda, you have been in the Tathagata's presence, showing loving kindness in acts of body, speech and mind, beneficial, blessedly, wholeheartedly and unstingingly. You have achieved much merit, Ananda. Make the effort, and in a short time you'll be free from all the corruptions. So here the Buddha is giving advice to his close disciple that it is not appropriate to weep for the Tathagata, because the nature of all conditions is to pass away. How can it be otherwise? And he predicts that if Ananda puts the effort in a short time, he will become fully enlightened. And then the Buddha, as he's lying on his deathbed, another wanderer of another sect comes up to the Buddha and tries to seek an interview as the Buddha's passing away. And at first, the monks try to stop that person from bothering the Buddha. But the Buddha's compassion is such, even though he's about to die, he sees the sincerity of this person and he chooses to teach that person, even though he's on his deathbed. So he tells the monks, do not block that wanderer, allow him to approach me. And then that wanderer asks the Buddha, he asks him about all other religious teachers. Is this religious teacher enlightened? Is that one enlightened? Is that one a saint? Is that one holy? And the Buddha said, do not concern yourself with others. I will teach you the Dhamma. And then he says to him, in whatever teaching, whatever Dhamma and discipline, the Noble Eightfold Path is not found. No ascetic is found. No ascetic of the stream enterers, no ascetics of the once returner, the non-returner, or the arahants. But such ascetics can be found of the stream enterer, once returner, non-returner, and arahant in those teachings and disciplines where the Noble Eightfold Path is to be found. So this is where the Buddha is saying that in those teachings, wherever there is the Noble Eightfold Path, then there you will find arahants, the enlightened ones, and those on the path to enlightenment. And therefore, he goes on to say, here, monks, the monks live the life of perfection. And if monks live the life of the Noble Eightfold Path, or people live the life of the Noble Eightfold Path, the world will not lack enlightened ones. So for us now, if we want to know, is it possible to get enlightened in this day and age? Is it possible that there are enlightened ones or those on the path to enlightenment here and now? We just have to look. Are people practicing the Noble Eightfold Path? Are we practicing the Noble Eightfold Path? And you can know that if you're practicing the Noble Eightfold Path, then you too can obtain enlightenment. The world will not be free from enlightened ones. And then the Ananda asked the Buddha, you should not think, Ananda asks the Buddha for instructions, further instructions. And the Buddha says, enough, Ananda, I have taught you the Dhamma. The Dhamma and discipline after my passing away should be your teacher. So now, as Buddhists, we take that advice that whatever happens, our refuge is in the Dhamma, in the discipline. That is our teacher, that is our guide, even though the Buddha has passed away. And then the Buddha, laying down on his right-hand side, said his final words, his final instructions. And he said to all those gathered around, now, monks, I declare to you, all conditioned things are of the nature to decay. Strive on untiringly. These were the Tathagata's last words. Then the Lord Buddha entered the meditative state of the first jhana, and leaving that state, he entered the second, the third, and the fourth jhana. Then leaving the fourth jhana, he entered the sphere of infinite space. Then entering the sphere of infinite consciousness, then the sphere of no-thingness or nothingness, then the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception, and leaving that, he obtained the cessation of feeling and perception. Then Venerable Ananda, who was standing watching the Buddhas at this final moment, said to one of the other monks there, the Venerable Anuruddha, and Anuruddha was the Buddha's foremost disciple in the ability to know the minds of others and the psychic abilities to know the minds. And Anuruddha was following the states of the Buddha's mind, where his mind was going through these experiences. But Venerable Ananda saw the Buddha's body being very still, and he said, the Buddha has passed away. The Buddha has passed away. And Anuruddha said to Ananda, no, the Buddha has not yet passed away. He's obtained the cessation of feeling and perception. and in that state the breath would not be distinguishable. Then the Lord Buddha, leaving the attainment of cessation of feeling and perception, entered the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception. From there he entered the sphere of nothingness, the sphere of infinite consciousness, the sphere of infinite space. The sphere of infinite space he entered the fourth jhana, from there the third, the second, and the first jhana. And leaving the first jhana, he went up through the jhanas again. He entered the second, the third, and the fourth. And leaving the fourth jhana, the Lord Buddha finally passed away. And it is said, at the Lord Buddha's final passing away, there was a great earthquake and great thunder. And those monks who were surrounding the Buddha at his final passing away, those monks who still had defilements, some of them were overcome with sorrow and they wept. They raised their hands, they threw themselves down, crying, "It is all too soon that the Lord Buddha has passed away. It is all too well, too soon that the welfarer has passed away. It is all too soon that the eye of the world has disappeared." But those monks who were free from craving endured mindfully, clearly aware, saying, "All compounded things are impermanent. What is the use of this? There is no need for tears." And then the Venerable Anuruddha said to the monks, "Friends, it is enough of your crying. Has not the Lord Buddha already told you that all things that are pleasant and delightful are changeable, subject to separation, to become other? So why all this, friends? Whatever is born, become, compounded in is subject to decay. It cannot be otherwise." So that is the description of the Lord Buddha's final days and final moments. Now it's an opportunity for all of us to reflect on the truth of the Buddha's teachings that all conditioned things will change. And so a day of recollection of the Buddha's birth, enlightenment, and passing away means a way of recalling with gratitude the compassion of the Enlightened One, that we have the merit to hear these teachings and apply them in our lives. For those people who may not be aware, this is my last talk at the Buddha Society. On June the 1st, I will be traveling to Thailand, as I have been invited to become the abbot of the International Forest Monastery there, which is the monastery where I trained at and that Ajahn Chah set up. And I had taken up that responsibility, and I'll be taking over that role from the 6th of June onwards. So I would like to thank all of you for your kind support over the years that I have been here. And I appreciate all your sincerity and your interest in the Buddhist path. And I wish all of you happiness and prosperity. And I hope that this noble virtue, noble concentration, noble wisdom, and noble liberation becomes an experience in your lives. And that you can have compassion and kindness on others and also assist them. So I would like at this moment to offer you a blessing, because some people I may not see again in the future. So I wish you happiness, prosperity, good health and well-being. Yatta varivaha pura paripurenti sagarang eva meva ito dindang petanang upakapati ichitang patitang tumhang kipameva samichatu sabbe purento sankapa chando panaraso yata manicho tiraso yata sabitiyo vivachantu sabbaroko vinasatu mate pavat vantarayo sukhi dikayuko pava apivatana silisanichang vadapachayino jattaro dhamma vadanti ayu vanno sukhang palang.